Perfect Stranglers contains graphic and explicit content suitable for mature listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Heidi ho there.
Hey, Stranglers, it's Bree.
Oh, I was going to call Heidi ho there, neighbor Bree.
Oh. Well, hey.
Well, hey. You know, for not liking Tim Allen, we sure do make a lot of Tim Allen references.
It's yeah. Time. I don't know.
I think we're just trolling him at this point.
Yeah. Just mocking him.
I don't know why. Well, Wilson wasn't Tim Allen. We liked Wilson.
Yeah.
And I guess we're. Yeah, I miss working in an,
Al was a sweetheart.
In an office. Yeah, I miss working in an office so I can just, like, pop over the cubicle, like, you know, area and mm-hmm. go, hey. You know, I really miss that. I used to have a Wilson. I used to, every time I moved my cubicle, I had a picture of Wilson that would just peek over so that my cubicle buddy could see it.
That's funny.
I'm that person. All right, so we left off last week. I have a story about New York's finest. All right, here's what happened. I showed up in New York. First time New York. Now, here's what you should know about me. Everywhere I go is chaos. I just sit here and it just happens around me. We don't know why, but it does. My boss has equated it to, I am basically like a brick house and people are, it's like a tornado around me and I am just a brick house that's sitting here minding my own fucking business.
Yeah.
And shit just happens everywhere and we don't, it's just has, ever since the lightning strike, my life has been like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, you're like a literal lightning rod for chaos.
I am. And I don't know why, but here's what happened. So the area that we were staying in New York is a relatively safe area. Like the one of the girls that I work with, she used to live in New York. She knows New York extremely well. Like if you're going to trust anyone to pick a good spot for you to stay in, you stay here. Mm-hmm. She has stayed at this place before, like no problems.
Yeah.
Then Kylie shows up and my Uber driver pulls me as we're driving. My Uber driver, we're getting right up to the hotel area or the Airbnb. And he sees another Uber driver, like, wave at him or he does something. I don't know. There must be, like, a hand signal they do. And my Uber driver's like, there's police presence where I'm supposed to drop you off. And I'm like, what? It wasn't late. It was, like, 9 at night on a Sunday night. It wasn't late, especially by New York standards. You know what I mean? And so we pull up over on the side of the road instead of where I'm supposed to go. And as soon as I open my door, we hear... As soon as we open the door, we hear three gunshots go off immediately. My Uber driver slams his door. He's like, get in the car. So I get in the car and I just sit there and I'm like, God damn it. He's like, I can't let you out of my vehicle. And I'm like, oh, cool. And as this is happening, we already see two police cars. More are coming. So something had already happened prior to us getting there because those police cars still had their lights on, but they were like getting out like right by their cars. Two more police cars pull up. There are four police cars in this like alley area that I'm supposed to be getting in. And they're starting to rope off, like get out the yellow tape, to rope everything off. About a couple minutes later, my Uber driver's like, listen, I have to let you out. Like, I got to let you out at some point. He could have at least walked me up to the door, but he didn't. And so I get up there and there's four police cars. I get into my building. One of the girls I work with, I tell her what happened. And she's like, you want to go get some food? And I was like, yeah, I want to go get some food. Let's go see what's going on. So I go downstairs. It's now roped off with the rope and everything. And there's the four squad cars. But then there's like the black SUVs, you know, that are definitely like detectives instead of just like regular cops in suits. In SWAT vests, and they have like the paper pads out and they're like writing shit down. And so Stacy and I walk around the corner and we look and she goes, oh my God. I don't know if she wants me to say her name, but you're on the podcast now. And she goes, Kylie, look. And I look and these men were so damn fine. Oh my God. These fucking men in uniform. I have never, they knew what they were doing. Their ass was popping. They had their short sleeves were fucking rolled up, tattooed. Like these police officers and detectives had sleeved tattoos. Haircut was like nice, high and tight, faded up. My God. I have, this is stuff that slutty romance novels are made out of. They were fully put together. And so we had to, I was like, I need something to eat because I hadn't eaten yet. And no restaurants were open, by the way, which is super fucking dumb. And so we went into the convenience store on the corner, which is where everything fucking happened at, apparently. And I'm in there and I'm like looking at the pretzels. I'm looking at the Pop-Tarts and all that stuff. And I like wanted food. And one of the detectives walk by and I look him up and down and I go, holy fuck. And he definitely heard me. And he looked at me and then he looked at Stacy and I looked at him and I just like kept staring at him. And I looked back at my food that I was looking at. And I was like, God damn, these men are fine as hell.
They looked like they smelled good. Did they smell good?
Yes, he did smell really, really good. They all look like they smell good.
Yeah.
I didn't listen. This is the stuff that slutty romance novels are made of. And they were all tall. They're all buff. They had some dump trucks and thighs. Fine as hell. And then when we were, they knew what they were doing. Don't even at me. And when we were walking by, World Trade Center building, there were cops everywhere around there, because there always is, and there were more of them lined up, just like tall, buff, and handsome. I was like, God damn! And everyone was like, Kylie, look, because they know me. They're like, I will not shy away. And I just like walking by, like, holy shit, this is of course, like, this is the best thing about New York, is New York's fucking finest. It's New York's finest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was the highlight of my trip. Wow.
Yeah, I think
was I showed up with gunshots.
I think that when we first started this podcast and me and Nicole were talking about the Golden Girls, that she accurately diagnosed you to be Blanche, because you're just totally blanching out right now. When you were talking about their thighs, I thought of like a very like famous Blanche quote where she says that she says, thighs that could choke a bear.
Yes. Yes.
And we have another announcement as well.
Let me get my reporter voice on. So, guys, this is going to be episode 42 of season 2. And we've been doing this for, it'll be almost, you know what? How many episodes? 51 plus 41. That is 92 episodes. We're going to be at 92 episodes. So Bree and I would have done this, and Nicole, for 92 episodes. And that is a lot. And we started this when COVID was going around and we didn't really have a lot to do. And it was a really, really good pastime and a hobby. And now that our world is kind of picking back up again, Nicole and I have gotten new jobs. I'm moving to a house. My daughter's getting older. Bree's like, you know, doing all of the things with her life. And we've decided to go out on a high note. And after season 2, we're going to be stopping Perfect Stranglers. And we feel good about it. I don't know if that's a bad thing or not, but like I feel good about it. Do you feel good about it?
I do. I feel like it's like, I don't know. I just feel like it's time.
I do too.
So, but
we want to end on a high note. It's not, even though you might be sad, I don't know. I don't feel like it's a sad thing. I feel like I'm really proud of everything we've done. We've learned a lot about podcasting. We've learned a shit ton about fucking serial killers and everything. So much. And I don't know. It's been a really good experience, but I think that all good things must come to an end. And honestly, you would not believe how much time this takes up.
Yeah. It was a good run, though. You know, it's not like we only did a couple. Like, we did a good run. And yeah. I want to personally thank all of our listeners who've been supporting us this entire time. We couldn't have done it without you, and we thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd like to get an episode with some really crazy listener stories. So if you have a story that you have wanted to send in, now's your time to do it because it's crunch time and we want your story to get heard. So please email us.
contact@perfectstranglers.com.
Yeah, or you can message us your story on Facebook or Instagram.
It's the final countdown. Should I bust out my clarinet? Yes. And you know what, guys? Y'all should be super fucking pumped because since this is the final sprint, we have a really good collab coming up. But two, this is going to be heavy hitter after heavy hitter after heavy hitter after heavy hitter after heavy hitter. Like, it is going to be, we're talking Dahmer, Gein, Bundy, Albert Fish, like all of the ones that you know, and I don't want to say know and love, but like know and want to hear about. We're going to be doing. This is going to be like our final sprint, like home run after home run. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, that's kind of our housekeeping. We also want you to rate, give us a rating. Let us know, you know, how we did, I guess.
I don't know. We're new to this. Let us, you know what? No, because you know what? Once this is done, our podcast is going to live on. Like, we're not taking it down.
Right.
You're still going to be able to, like, listen to them all and share them. And our social media is going to stay up and I'll monitor it from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, still go on Spotify, rate us 5 stars, go on Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star rating, leave us a review. You can still comment on all of our social media. That's staying up. And you know, if you miss our lovely voices at any time, it's all going to be there.
Yeah. For future generations.
Forever. My daughter is going to be like 20 years old listening to this, being like, Mom, you talked about your vagina being the color of a strawberry milkshake. She'll go, that sounds about right. Oh my God. Ooh, well, yeah. I stand by it.
And still subscribe to us because if you're not subscribed to us, then you're going to miss out on, like, all of these really big, awesome episodes. And you don't want to miss our finale, so subscribe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That being said, what are we doing today?
So today, we have the Amazon Review Killer.
Never heard of it. Excited about it.
Todd Cole Hepp. And it's a recent case, and actually, once I get into it, you might actually remember it from the news.
Okay, Todd Cole Hepp. Have you ever seen the episode of Boy Meets World? Judy Heppefeld.
That sounds very familiar.
You know what I'm talking about?
That sounds really familiar.
That's what that reminded me of.
Okay.
That's it. That's my comment.
So the Amazon review part of this story is a very small part of this nutso story. Okay, so Todd Cole Hepp, he was a bad seed from the very beginning. There were many warning signs of his behavior in young childhood that would all lead to, like, escalating into him becoming a mass murderer. Todd Cole Hepp was born March 7th, 1971 in Florida, but was raised in South Carolina and Georgia. When he was 2 years old, his parents got divorced. His mom had custody of him, and she remarried when Todd was 3. He was described by his teachers as a troublesome child, and in nursery school, he was aggressive towards other children, and he would destroy their property and their drawings and stuff like that. He had a very poor relationship with his stepfather, and he often asked to live with his real dad, who he hadn't seen in 8 years and barely knew. Thankfully, his mom put him in therapy, but he needed more therapy for longer, I think. And even then, it's still a gamble if he would have turned out to be a killer still.
Yeah.
So at age 9, he started counseling because of his preoccupation with sexual content and his rageful, explosive temper. At age 9.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He also displayed a classic warning sign of future killer, and that is animal cruelty.
Oof.
He shot a dog with a BB gun. He killed a goldfish by pouring bleach into the fishbowl because he didn't want it anymore and he wanted a hamster. So he killed his goldfish by bleaching it. God. He was a sadist and continued through adulthood. That continued through adulthood. He actually spent 3.5 months in an inpatient psychiatric hospital in Georgia due to his inability to get along with other children. In 1982, his mom and stepdad divorced, but would end up remarrying and separating several more times, which sounds really dysfunctional. In 1983, when Todd was 12, he got his wish to live with his real dad, who lived in Arizona. His real dad turned out to be a very bad influence on Todd. They collected weapons together, and Todd's dad taught him how to blow up things and make bombs. Despite them bonding over dangerous and unsavory things like weapons and bombs, their relationship soon took a turn when Todd's dad would leave Todd alone at the house all hours of the day and night as he entertained his many lady friends, not making sure that Todd was fed and safe. Todd would have rather been living back with his mom, and he asked to do so many times, but his mom kept making excuses to lengthen his stay in Arizona. Seems like she didn't want to deal with Todd either. And as a matter of fact, Todd lived with his mother, she had to lock him in his room at night and lock herself in her room because she was afraid that he would, like,
yeah,
hurt her or kill her.
I could not imagine
in her sleep.
Holy shit.
Yeah. He committed his first really bad crime in Arizona in 1986 when he kidnapped a 14-year-old neighbor girl that he had a crush on at gunpoint. He took her to his dad's house where he was unsupervised. This girl had been babysitting her younger siblings, so they were then, like, home alone. So when he took her to his dad's house, he tied her up, taped her mouth shut, and raped her. And he told her that if she told anyone that he would kill her and her parents and her siblings.
Oh my God.
So he was like, I can't remember how old he was. He was a couple of years older than this 14-year-old girl. So he was still a teenager himself. He was like 15 or 16, something like that. So Todd was so, like, delusional and so convinced of his power and superiority that he really thought that she wouldn't tell anyone about what he did. Mm-hmm. This girl had a 5-year-old brother who was now at home alone, who had just been taught what to do if there was an emergency. And he was concerned about the whereabouts of his sister, and he called 911. And as her 5-year-old brother was on the phone with 911, she walked back in the house because Todd let her go. And she got on the phone with a 911 operator and told them what had just happened to her. And when Todd was arrested, he was only concerned with how much trouble he was in and how much time he'd be doing for it. He was sent to prison at the age of 16 for the next 15 years. It did him no favors, and he was not rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. The judge said that Todd was very bright and should be advanced academically, but behaviorally and emotionally, he is dangerous and likely could not be rehabilitated. His probation officer wrote a similar summary in court papers and also added that Todd felt that the world owed him something. So after spending half his life, his formative years in prison, Todd was released after 14 years in 2001 at the age of 30, and he moved to South Carolina. During his time in prison, he had the opportunity to go to college through Central Arizona College, and he graduated with a bachelor's degree in computer science. This helped him get a job as a graphic designer until 2003, when he started going to school at Greenville Technical College. A year later, he transferred to University of South Carolina upstate, and he graduated in 2008 with a bachelor's degree in marketing and business administration. While he was going to school there, he applied for a real estate license. He lied about his felony in order to get this license. So, yeah, he was a registered sex offender because of the rape that he had been imprisoned for. They raised this issue with him while reviewing his application, and what he did was submit a letter that downplayed everything, basically explaining it as a misunderstanding between himself and a girlfriend. So basically what he said was that, like, it was something like a disagreement between him and his girlfriend, and that the kidnapping thing was because he told her, like, no, sit down, you're not going anywhere, we're gonna work out this argument between us before you leave, or something like that, which was completely not what happened at all.
Right.
So, I mean, basically, he just completely lied his ass off. And apparently it worked, because he was granted his real estate license. And he started, and he started his own firm. He looked just like this normal, educated entrepreneur. And he was recognized as a top-selling agent in the region. He also got his pilot license and started getting into motorcycles. And all of this added to his macho, alpha male, egotistical persona.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he was into guns still, just like when he was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And so he presented himself as this upstanding, law-abiding citizen, but bits of his real personality would show through at times. Mm-hmm. On his website for his real estate firm, he joked that he would, like, beat his agents and not give them food if they didn't make sales or something, like, something stupid like that.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So also one of his customers that sold their house through Todd remembered him as being very outgoing and professional, although sometimes he'd mention his firearms and subtly use subtle innuendos in their conversation.
That's weird.
Yeah. Todd was frequently condescending with his employees and would regularly watch pornography at the office.
Wait, what's this guy's last name? Todd?
Kohlhepp.
How do you spell it? K-O-H-L-H-E-P-P? Ew.
Yes.
He looks like he'd be, he is nasty looking.
Yeah. Yeah. Like one of the psychopaths that, like, work their way up through the business ladder from just being, like, having no conscience.
Yes.
He
does look like that. He looks like what you picture. He looks like what you picture an extremely buttoned up white collar, white right wing, like, extremist to look like.
And I'm pretty sure that he was, like, right wing, like, conservative, like, bigot. Yeah.
Like an extremist.
Because he's also.
Yeah. He's so weird. His body. He has a tiny head, but a huge body.
He was like a doomsday prepper, I'm pretty sure, because he had like, he had a stockpile of guns, which he got illegally because he was a felon and wasn't supposed to have guns, but somebody was buying them for him and like selling them to him, like a straw sale is what they call it. What were you gonna say?
He reminds me that you saying that he reminds me of he's on the same lines of like Israel Keyes and the Chevy Kehoe brothers.
Yes.
The Chevy Tahoe brothers, the Kehoes. And Brady Ostrich, the Craigslist killer.
Yep. Yeah, actually, if you watch his interrogation, it really, really reminded me of Israel Keyes. Just how he was like telling it like it was a good memory.
Okay. Wow, this man, when I tell you, when you guys Google him, last name Kohlhepp, K-O-H-L-H-E-P-P, the pictures of him in a blue shirt, it looks like a different head on a different body. His head is so fucking tiny. This man's shoulders are broad as fuck. How tall is he? He is a tall ass motherfucker.
He is. He's got to be over 6 foot.
No. Really? He's not. Wait. Tall, okay. I'm seeing 5'10". There's no way. He has to be at least 6'5".
No. Yeah, he looks like a big dude.
We need to know how tall he is. His height isn't known. There's no way his height isn't known. He's a criminal. Anyway.
It's known somewhere.
This man has to be at least 6'5".
Yeah, I was going to guess 6'3".
Just looking at him around other people.
Above 6 foot. At least 6 foot.
No, his thing says he's only 5'11". Looking at him standing
he
next.
He just looks like a big
dude. Yeah, I think it's just his broad shoulders. Okay, anyway.
Yeah. So, he was successful, but he did occasionally creep people out. Those people had very good reason to feel creeped out in his presence, though, because as it turns out, Todd was already a murderer.
Yeah.
Like, when he was, you know, selling all these houses and stuff like that. He just hadn't been found out yet. So, Todd, when he got out of prison, he started got his pilot license, started getting into motorcycles. He would often visit this shop called Superbike Motorsports.
Yeah.
And he would look at the bikes that he wanted to buy. This was in 2003. He would go to the motorsports shop. He would sit on the bikes, talk to the owners and other employees of the shop. And eventually he bought a bike, and it turned out to be a little bit too big of a bike for Todd to handle. And he went back to the bike shop and asked to return the bike and get a refund or a trade-in. And the owner refused this and kind of teased him about it, about not knowing how to ride and buying a bike that he couldn't handle. Which, this really infuriated and humiliated Todd and challenged his masculinity. Todd didn't do anything about it.
How dare you challenge a man's masculinity?
Right? Todd didn't do anything about it right away. And actually, his bike was stolen 2 weeks later from outside of his apartment complex, which I also found interesting that, wait, this was in 2003. I can't remember when he got his real estate license, but I think it'd be odd if your real estate agent lived in an apartment and was trying to sell you houses. I don't know. Is that weird or not?
I think it depends on.
Maybe in this market, it's not. I think
it depends on. Well, this was 2003, you said?
Yeah, so the housing market was like,
it was still fine.
It was, I think that was maybe like just before the housing bubble burst.
Yeah. So he, you know what, it depends on the apartment, because, you know, it just, I don't know, it just depends on the apartment.
That's true, too. It could have been a really sweet apartment. Yeah. So he would, so anyway, this bike got stolen. That was too big for him to ride, and he kept going back into the dealership that was like that, like teased him or whatever. Yeah. Because he was looking, he just really wanted to buy another bike. Also, I think it was a chance. It was like a way for him to allow them the chance to like run their mouth to him again and cross him again, so that he could justify what he was about to do.
He could instigate it.
Yeah. So on December 6th. 2003, Todd left his afternoon class at Greenville Tech and drove to a CVS where he prepped himself by putting on a shoulder holster with a 9mm handgun that had been outfitted with a silencer, and he put a coat on over it. He drove to the Superbike Motorsports and stalled for time and waited until there were no other customers but him in the shop, and then he told the shop owner, Scott Ponder, that he wanted to buy the bike that he was sitting on, and one of the employees took it back into the back to prep it and to get the paperwork started. He waited a minute or two before going to the back of the shop where the paperwork was being prepared, and he opened fire on the employee, killing him. Todd then killed the mechanic and the bookkeeper, who was also the shop owner's mother. And he killed the shop owner as well, who had been running towards the exit door.
Oh my God.
In his taped interrogation, he confessed years later. Todd recounts this like he is just reminiscing some old glory days and good times and just bragging about it, saying that it was just like a video game and that he cleared the whole building in about 30 seconds. And he told the officers that if they'd seen it, they would have been impressed.
Oh my God. Yeah. Fuck you, Todd.
Yeah.
Never met a good Todd.
He also added that he didn't even mean to hit the mom because he'd prefer to not shoot women if he can. but she got in the way and was not a primary target. As if that matters.
Oh my god. Fuck you. Fuck you, bitch.
Right. Before Todd left, he went and did a walkthrough and gave each victim a headshot to make sure they were dead.
Jesus fucking Christ.
And then he went home, and he disposed of the gun in a bag of kitty litter and threw it in a dumpster at his apartment complex. On the news that night, word of the quadruple homicide at the motorbike shop broke, and a man who had been in the shop just before the murders saw this on the news and contacted the police. The man had been in the shop paying on his payment plan, and he had his 4-year-old son with him. And he remembered seeing another guy in the bike shop, and that's how police came up with a sketch, which really, I don't think, looked that much like Todd. And that worked well to Todd's advantage, because he never got caught for it until he was confessing as he was being questioned for something else. So Todd kept living his life, blending into society for the most part, even though he was a real creep. Fast forward to 2015. He would frequent a Waffle House where he was so creepy to the waitresses that eventually they had a male cook come out and take his order instead of having the waitresses have to deal with him.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
He would, that's like, crazy.
He would give them like really big tips and like invite them to his house and stuff like that.
Oh, come on. Gross.
And it's a Waffle House, okay? It's not Hooters.
Exactly.
Where I know a lot of the girls at Hooters would, like, get, like, their college paid for and, like, get laptops and stuff like that because they would just the atmosphere is different. And it's very different. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hooters culture. I don't know. I never worked at Hooters and I never would. I'm not, like, saying that it's bad, but I did know somebody who did work at Hooters, and that's where I get my information from. So, this Waffle House restaurant was presumably where Todd met Megan Lee McCraw Coxey, because she was a waitress there. She was 26 years old, and she had a 29-year-old husband named Johnny, and they were both hired to do some work on Todd's property. They were a young couple of modest means, and they had both been known to have a drug habit, which may have led them to overlook Todd's creep factor in order to work for him. Mm-hmm. Megan and Johnny were reported missing on December 22nd, 2015, and you guessed it, Todd Kohlhepp was responsible for their disappearance. He brought them to his property to work, and Todd claims that they were going to rob him, and that he shot Johnny when he drew a knife out on him. He kept Megan alive and kept her in a shipping container in the back portion of his property that he said he originally intended to store his 4-wheelers and guns and ammo in. So it's like one of those metal shipping containers. Mm-hmm. Like you can get like those pod things, you know, like when you're moving or whatever, you can get them. It's always like that.
Okay.
In his confession, he says that the killing really bothered him because this land was supposed to be a sanctuary where he could get away from people, not his killing field. So not real concerned about human life, just concerned about giving up his sanctuary and having to bury a body. He also added that it's a lot harder to bury a body than you'd think. Todd said he kept Megan there for 5 or 6 days and that she'd go crazy every now and then and go into a manic mode and then she'd calm down. He said that she wanted Little Caesar's pizza every other damn day and Dr. Pepper. And he said that he hates Little Caesar's because it gives him heartburn.
Oh my God.
And he just gave all these like stupid details that it's like, just get to the point, dude. Nobody cares that you get heartburn from Little Caesars.
I hate an over-explainer. I hate an over-explainer. Yeah.
So he also says he got her cinnamon rolls and Newports.
Cream cheese or like icing, you wonder? I hope it was cream cheese. Sorry.
I enjoy both.
You know, important stuff.
So one day, Megan tried to burn down the shipping container. Or burn what was in it, or whatever.
All right. Yeah.
Because Todd promised her $4,000 and for him to take her to Tennessee and turn her loose. Uh-huh. And that they'd go their own separate ways after that. Todd thought that she wouldn't want to go for help from law enforcement because of her drug charges in the past. So when it had been 2 days since he had promised this and he still hadn't taken her, she set the shipping container on fire and trashed all of Todd's belongings that were stored in there. The reason that Todd hadn't gotten around to taking her yet was because it was around Christmas time, and the weather had not been nice for several hours drive that it would take. And also, Todd had to find time that he could sneak out and do this without his girlfriend Ashley finding out. Yes, this monster had a girlfriend who was completely unaware.
My jaw dropped. Holy shit.
So, when Megan burnt and damaged the shipping container, Todd figured that she was more trouble than what she was worth to him at that point, and he shot her and buried her. Again, police had no leads to the killer, and 8 months later, Todd would kill again. On September 4th, 2016, a call was made by the parents of Charlie Carver to police to report their 32-year-old son missing, along with his girlfriend, 30-year-old Kayla Brown, who was also missing. What had happened was that Kayla was contacted in late August by her buddy Todd Kohlhepp. Todd and Kayla had met through an ex of hers, and she had previously cleaned houses for him for his real estate listings. So that's how they knew each other. Todd asked her if she would like to do some work clearing brush on his property, and said that Charlie could also help, and they could make some money. And so this couple was lured in a similar fashion to Megan and Johnny, and they also met a similar fate. When Charlie Carver's parents called to make the missing persons report, their son was already dead. Todd had killed Charlie on August 31st, 2016, and kept Kayla in the shipping container until October, when she was found alive, chained up in the dark shipping container. The story of how she was discovered and how all the dominoes fell afterward is crazy. And Kayla's statements to police and EMTs after she was rescued are absolutely chilling. As the investigation went on in search for Kayla and Charlie, the family noticed something off and very weird about Charlie's Facebook. Charlie had been responding to people on Facebook, telling people that he and Kayla were fine, but that they just wanted to be left alone, and it just didn't sound like how Charlie speaks.
Yeah.
And Charlie was not known to be very active on Facebook anyways.
Yeah.
So the fact that he was on there and replying to people and being snarky to people was completely out of character for him. Also, Charlie's Facebook profile was sharing and liking the missing persons posts of himself and Kayla.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it was really weird.
Yep, that's suspicious.
Highly suspicious. Also, they had left everything in their house and left their dog with no food or water, which they would never have done. So obviously it was Todd responding through Charlie's Facebook. The police got a hold of Charlie and Kayla's phone records, and they discovered that the last ping was on Todd's property. The property was 90-some acres, a few miles away from Todd's actual house. The police received a search warrant for the property, so on November 3rd, 2016, at about 8 a.m., one group of investigators went to Todd's house, and one went to his parcel of land. Police carefully and guardedly asked Todd what he knew about the missing people, Kayla and Charlie, and Todd said, "Oh, you're trying to find the girl." And the police corrected him and said that they were trying to locate both Charlie and Kayla. So he kind of slipped up there.
Yeah.
Because he was the only one that knew that Charlie was dead.
Uh-huh.
So on the other property, police found two structures, a shipping container and an actual small building, like a garage with a bathroom in it. In the small garage, they found a mattress and chains that were affixed to the wall. They found reddish-brown hair clippings in the garbage in the bathroom that were the color of Kayla's hair. while investigating, they started to hear banging and yelling on the side of the metal shipping container. The shipping container had 5 padlocks on it that they had to cut through to open it. Once they got into the shipping container, they went inside and they found Kayla Brown alive in the back of the shipping container, chained by her neck and feet, and she was also handcuffed. She was sitting on top of a dog bed that she had been made to sleep on for months. She could barely move because of how the restraints were on her, and she had to sleep sitting up. They immediately cut her out of the chains after snapping photographic evidence. They assured her that she was safe now, and as they cut the chains with a bolt cutter. As she was being cut out of the chains, in a moment of bravery and strength, she calmly and clearly told the officers, "Todd Kohlhepp shot Charlie Carver 3 times in the chest, wrapped him in a blue tarp and put him in a bucket of the tractor, locked me down here, and I never seen him again. Todd says he's dead and buried, and he says there's several bodies dead and buried out here. He says that the dogs would be ruined if they ever go looking because there's red pepper everywhere."
Yeah.
And just like she had been rehearsing it.
Oh my God.
Over and over for months of like what she was going to say once she got rescued. When Kayla was in the ambulance, she gave more details about the 2 months that she had spent as a victim of Todd Kohlhepp. She would spend all day in the shipping container except from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. At those times, Todd would get her out and take her into the garage on the property and force her to perform sexual acts on him. If she refused, he said he wouldn't rape her because he didn't believe in rape, but that she would no longer be of use to him if she didn't. And since she had seen him kill Charlie, she knew that he meant he would kill her.
Jesus.
So, still rape.
Yep, still rape.
She would be fed and allowed to use the bathroom once, and she would be given a small container of water to clean herself up. Kayla noticed Todd's narcissistic personality and played to it in order to survive. Todd provided her with books and coloring books that she asked for to pass her time. Todd ordered them off of Amazon. As it turns out, Todd ordered a lot of things off of Amazon. Mm-hmm. And investigators found this out while they were looking at Todd's phone. They're the kind of reviews, he left reviews on Amazon. They're the kind of reviews that a person reading them would probably take them as a joke from someone who has a twisted sense of humor. But in Todd's case, he might not have been joking at all on some of these. Let me read a few to you. All right. For the master padlock, 5 stars. Solid locks. Have 5 on a shipping container. Won't stop them, but sure will slow them down till they're too old to care. Oh. And he did have 5 locks on that shipping container.
Oh my God.
For the SOG, that's S-O-G, the company. SOG Pentagon Fixed Blade. Uh-huh. It's a knife. 4 stars. I haven't stabbed anyone yet. .. But I am keeping the dream alive, and when I do, it will be with a quality tool like this.
Holy shit.
Another one is the SOG entrenching tool, which is like a small shovel. It says, 5 stars. Keep in your car for when you have to hide the bodies and you left the full-size shovel at home. Does not come with a midget.
Jesus, Todd.
Like,
oh, he's so funny.
Yeah, right.
God, he's so funny.
So, yeah. So yeah, those are his reviews. He's a sicko, for sure. Todd was arrested immediately when Kayla was found because, you know, the police were already talking to him. They were already at his house. One group of them was. They put him in cuffs. Then he was taken to an interrogation room where he confessed in exchange for allowing him to talk to his mother, give his mother a photograph, and to transfer money to the college fund of a friend's child. So the whole confession is really, really long, the whole interrogation video. I watched a good chunk of it. Todd said that he didn't want to write out his whole confession because he said he writes for a living and his hands hurt. So the detectives had to write it all out as he was telling his confession. They often had him stop after each sentence to catch up, and they told him that he talks fast and uses big words. And Tom, Todd seemed annoyed at this at times, but a lot of people apparently say that this was a deliberate tactic, though.
Oh, yeah.
By making Todd feel like he is smarter than them and by playing dumb, it may encourage Todd to speak more freely and let his guard down a bit so he can brag about all of what he considers his accomplishments.
That's smart.
Also, by writing it out and telling him that he's talking too fast for them to write it out, they made him repeat key details and have him say them multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
So someone might ask, why would you need a written out confession in the first place when it was all being recorded on video on closed circuit surveillance? Well, it may be because most suspects don't realize that they're being recorded. Having someone write down their words in front of them might make someone more likely to believe that their conversation isn't being taped and immortalized forever in video,
mm-hmm.
And they may share more of the risky details. The cops really got buddy-buddy with him, and he just opened up and started chatting away as if they were old buddies. And they even ate dinner with him in a...
Ooh.
Yeah. They dined with him in this interrogation room.
What a weird life.
They, they ate burgers and fries and sweet tea.
Say hi to Johnny.
Oh, hi. He's so cute.
Miko won't let me go. Aww. I know, he missed me.
Got a little socks.
So Miko's gonna listen to the rest of this with us. Yeah.
Todd admitted to the murders of the four victims at the Superbike Motorsports, as well as murders of Megan and Johnny Coxie and Charlie Carver, and the kidnapping of Kayla Brown as well. Todd Coldhep pleaded guilty to 7 counts of murder, 2 counts of kidnapping, and 1 count of criminal sexual assault, and he entered a plea bargain that spared him from the death penalty, and he was instead sentenced to 7 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole, plus 60 years. Relatives of the Superbike victims opened a wrongful death lawsuit against him, and Kayla Brown also filed her own civil lawsuit against Todd Coldhep and was awarded $6.3 million.
All right.
Also, the guy who bought all the guns for Todd also was got some prison time.
Good.
So Todd Colhep's never going to see the light of day again.
Good.
As a free man.
You shouldn't.
No.
That is, I can't believe I've never heard of that. I've never heard of that guy.
I remember finding that girl in the shipping container alive. I do remember that part, but I don't remember anything. I mean, I remember like that being breaking news and I'm like, holy shit.
God, that's crazy.
But, and I was just like amazed that she was alive and like,
yeah.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
But I didn't follow it. So I was glad to see that they basically put him under the jail.
Yeah. Basically, oh my god, what a disgusting fucking human being.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely disgusting. I just cannot, after all of this time, I still cannot fathom people who do this stuff.
Yeah, he was really messed up.
Like, I can't comprehend it still.
And like, what did his girlfriend think, you know?
Right. That's the other thing, is like, when you're with someone like that, it was very clear from an early age that he was not okay.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way that...
I'm sure that he never told her anything like that. Or if he did, he, like, you know, twisted the truth about it. She let her kid around this dude.
It had to have been like, oh, this guy's, like, a little bit off. You know what I mean?
I mean, unless she was off, too.
Like, there's no way he seemed normal. Yeah, unless she was off and just oblivious.
There was also a girl who... he was like cheating on his girlfriend with, her name was Holly, and she said that Todd...
You guys can all probably hear Miko meow, cute. Miko purring right now.
I love
now.
Cat purrs. This girl, that he was cheating on Ashley with, her name was Holly, and she said that, Holly said that Todd just made her feel really special, and he would like spend time with her and stuff. And then when Kayla was talking in the ambulance and giving all the details, she said that Todd was talking about some girl named Holly that he planned to kill. And so this Holly, you know, learned about this later and was absolutely horrified that he was a murderer already, B, yeah, that he had a girlfriend,
I'm sure,
C, that he was planning to kill her. Like,
yeah.
Like, what a psycho.
Oh my God. I guess what is wrong with people?
Yeah. Crazy, crazy psycho.
I can't fathom it.
Like, he should have been monitored. Like, I mean, he had to have been monitored somewhat being on the sex offender registry, but clearly not enough. And
he had to, not enough.
Yeah. Like, not at all.
Oh my God. I cannot even.
He should have been monitored, like, forever.
People like that are, like, never monitored. Never.
Yeah.
There was a killer in, I want to say it's Moose Lake, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Through the 70s and 80s. And he had raped, kidnapped, assaulted, like, teenagers and younger women over and over and over again for years. For years. And they kept on letting him out. And he finally got put away into prison for life after he kidnapped. He pretty much did exactly what Israel Keyes did. And he was finally mm-hmm. put away for life. I forget his name, but it was in Moose Lake, Minnesota.
Do you know what stories I love hearing about? I just read this one where this woman, her husband raped her child. So it was the stepfather of this child.
Yeah.
And she boiled a bunch of water and she put like two like bags of sugar in it so it'd be stickier and like really
hell yeah
like sink into the skin uh-huh. better. And she poured this boiling sugar water over this dude for like assaulting her child.
I love it. I love it. Did she get any prison time or anything for it?
Yes she did, but I mean,
I support her.
What are you gonna do? You know,
I support her. Like, hell yeah. Hell yeah. That's what a parent does.
It's justified. I wouldn't recommend, like, I wouldn't say to do that, but, I mean,
it's justified. Yeah. I would say that's justified. Absolutely.
But
it was justified.
Yeah. It was justified.
But it was justified. Oh my God. I love that. Well, that was a fucked up story, Brie. I still can't believe I've never heard of that, and I cannot believe that he's only 5'11". 5'10", 5'11". Y'all have to Google him, because he literally looks like Gru. I think it's Gru from Despicable Me.
Yeah.
The big shoulders, tiny head. Yeah, yep. That's what he looks like. Yep, absolutely. All right, kids. Thank you so much for listening. You have now entered the final countdown era of Perfect Stranglers, because you only have 9 episodes left after this. And that's that on that. All right, guys. We will chit-chat with you next Thursday. Thank you for listening. We love you, and goodbye.
Bye, everyone.